This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Anything Goes Friday. We're taking your calls. I just wanted to remind you, as we may be moving into this kind of emergency powers area, that we have been through this as a country before. In 1951, as I recall, maybe it was 52, Harry Truman was prosecuting the Korean War. And he wanted to seize U.S. Steel. He wanted to seize a steel mill and force them to only manufacture steel for the war effort. He wanted to kind of get back to a World War II footing with regard to the Korean War. And the American people were not happy with this, by the way. In fact, Dwight Eisenhower ran on a campaign in the 1952 election of, and you've probably heard me many times play the clip on this program, Vote for Peace, Vote for Eisenhower. Now, that was, you know, a paid film. That was what the ad said. And it was because people were fed up with Harry Truman and the Korean War. They, you know, the Korean War was this terrible, brutal, and unauthorized, it lacked congressional authorization war. And we had just had a real war, an authorized war, World War II, and people were like, the Republicans in particular were like, this is not legal. So Truman said, I want to seize this steel mill and redirect all of its output specifically to making tanks and things like that. And he actually did so. He signed an executive order to make that happen. The steel mill protested, and it was Youngstown's Sheet and Tube Company. And in a case, a Supreme Court case that is very famous among lawyers, it's called Youngstown Sheet and Tube v. Sawyer. The Supreme Court ruled that Harry Truman did not have the power to spend money to require Youngstown Sheet and Tube to shut down their operations for commercial purposes and just dedicate their output to the military. Now, the spend money part of that is the key to the whole thing. If you read the Supreme Court decision, they didn't say, Harry, you don't have the power to make an emergency declaration. He certainly had that power. And they didn't say, you don't have the power to prosecute the war in Korea, although that's still debatable to this day. That wasn't what was before them. The question was, could the president's office use money that had been appropriated by Congress for running the executive branch, could he use that to shut down the steel mill? And this is Justice William O. Douglas, and this Marjorie Cohn wrote a piece about this over on Truth Out. A tip of the hat to Jim Turr, an old friend who pointed it out to me. This is from Justice Robert Jackson's concurring opinion, actually. He says, first, when the president acts with express or implied authority of Congress, his power is at its greatest. Right. And Congress had not authorized money to Truman to use to shut down the steel mill. See, it takes money to do pretty much anything, right? You got to hire somebody to go do it and deal with the problems and everything else. Congress hadn't done that. He said, second, in the absence of a grant or prohibition by Congress, the president can rely only on his own powers. He acts in a twilight zone where he and Congress may have concurrent authority or their distribution of power remains uncertain. In this area, any actual test of power is likely to depend on the imperatives of events and contemporary imponderables rather than on abstract theories of law. Okay. And then third, when the president seeks to circumvent the expressed or implied will of Congress, which is clearly what Trump is doing here, quote, his power is at its lowest ebb, for then he can rely only upon his own constitutional powers minus any constitutional powers of Congress over the matter. Any presidential claim of such power, quote, must be scrutinized with caution, for what is at stake is the equilibrium established by our constitutional system. I think it's entirely possible. We all know that the reason Trump put Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court was because Brett Kavanaugh publicly had been stating rather loudly in recent days, prior to Trump reaching out to him. He wasn't on Trump's original list, and so he published this piece about how, I don't think the president should be prosecutable. And suddenly he was on Trump's list. But, and in all probability, Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito will do whatever Trump wants. I mean, they're to the right of Trump. But, because Trump has no ideology anyway. But I'm getting the sense that John Roberts is saying enough already. We're not going to go down this crazy train road. I'm I don't have any evidence for this other than, you know, a few recent decisions where he's basically backing away from right-wing wackadoodle positions. I think that John Roberts is starting to worry about his legacy. But, you know, we'll see. We'll see. Anyhow, it's Anything Goes Friday. Picking up your calls, Mark in San Diego. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, John. I love these Anything Goes Friday because I've been wanting to ask you this question for a long, long time to get your opinion on it. Why is the right wing, their heads exploding over Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a freshman congresswoman who just barely has taken the oath of office? I mean, I can't go on Facebook with any day without seeing some kind of article, who knows where it comes from, that blasts her. They just are obsessed with her. And I just want to know what your opinion is. Why her, and why this freshman congresswoman?
Well, first of all, she's young, she's attractive, she's smart, she's articulate, she's gregarious, she's all the things that the press loves, and so she's drawing the attention of the press. But more importantly, she said that she's a democratic socialist. And the billionaire oligarchs who fund the right-wing media machines and the right-wing think tanks are flipped out by that. They are libertarians, the Koch brothers and many of the others, the Mercers and whatnot. These people adhere, generally speaking, to a libertarian philosophy. The government should not be providing health care, should not be providing Social Security in old age, should not be doing basically the things that we all agree are the province of government. And so as she comes out and says, no, government should, she's talking like FDR, basically. And it's making them crazy because they saw what happened when FDR got into the White House. The people reelected him. He was elected president 4 times. I mean, it made them absolutely crazy. And they're doing everything. And that's why they're even rewriting history. Like I said a couple days ago, Google FDR, and you're going to find all these anti-FDR sites that come up first. The right has just, you know, they have seeded the internet with this. And they're flipped out about AOC. They're just terrified of her. And of course, when the right gets terrified, they attack. So that's what, in my opinion, Mark, is going on. Thanks a lot for the call. Kathleen in Astoria, New York. Hey, Kathleen. Thanks for watching us on Facebook Live. What's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. Hopefully the same is true for you.
Well, I'm getting over bronchitis, so I don't hope I don't cough during my questions. But one of the ones, I recently picked up Ralph Nader's book, To the Ramparts, How Bush and Obama Paved the Way for Trump Presidency. Mm-hmm. I haven't really started reading it yet, and I'm wondering if it even covers how Obama had deregulated the propaganda law that was in place to stop the U.S. from using propaganda on its own citizens. And then that led me to, I don't know if you heard about the recent brownout in Astoria, where the whole sky lit up like the Aurora Borealis, and it shut down power to LaGuardia Airport and Rikers Island.
Was that the one where the sky was like
thousands of people in New York?
That was where the sky was.
Have you heard about that?
That was the one where the sky was some bizarre color because I think it was green because the transformer was filled with copper.
Well, that's the explanation that they're giving. I mean, my mom worked at Con Edison, and in the 80s, there was a time when they wanted to evacuate all of Astoria within 10 minutes because they couldn't find a shutoff valve to a gas tank. Mm. And there was mayhem in the streets, traffic backed up. I mean, we are in the center of New York where anybody trying to escape from the UN basically would have to go through Astoria to get to the two major airports. Mm-hmm. And we don't have an evacuation plan. So, I mean, my fear is that even if this Trump trying to use emergency powers to take over, that they could propagandize any kind of situation with, you know, what's going on now.
Yeah, he doesn't need a 9/11. He can make them up, which is what he's done with the border emergency.
And basically our infrastructure. I mean, we have an aging infrastructure at Con Edison, at Indian Point, that really should be spending the billions on.
Yeah, absolutely. You want to spend $5 billion? Well, you could also, you know, provide free college education to, I think, pretty much every kid in the United States for several years. Kathleen, spot on. Thank you very much for the call. Our priorities are all screwed up, right? And Donald Trump is the prima facie evidence of that.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's 15 minutes past the hour. It's Anything Goes Friday on the Tom Hartman Program. Back with your calls right after this. And welcome back. Joan in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Joan, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I want to refer to the first call of today. about the, I think the caller was mentioning whites confronting other whites when they're being racist.
Yes, yeah, that was.
And I think I mentioned this once before that, you know, whites are the only ones who can correct other whites as far as that is concerned.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like men listen to other men, whites listen to other whites, and, you know, on down the line. But, and I've only seen that happen. I watch a lot of news, and I've only seen that happen four times. It's so rare I can remember the people who confronted white racism. One is Michael Moore. One is Rob Reiner. The other one is Max Boot. And the other one is an ex-congressman or senator. And when they do that, the whites who are spewing the racism, you can see the expression on their face that it does impact them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more effective when it comes from one of your own, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And the thing about the destruction of democracy, this country was built on racism, and racism, in my opinion, will destroy it. First of all, if Trump was anyone other than a rich white male, he would be gone by now. If Obama had done anything like Trump is doing when he was in office, they would have hanged him from a tree on the White House lawn.
Well, they certainly would have impeached him, John.
Definitely. They would have found a reason. He would have been gone within 2 or 3 months of being in office. He would not be still in office causing the damage to democracy that Trump is being allowed to do. And I know there's a process, and I believe in processes, but we both know that that process, this process that we are going through now, would have been circumvented had Obama done any of the things that Trump is doing.
I think that the wall for Trump is this news cycle's variation on the long-form birth certificate for Trump during the 8 years that President Obama was president. During those years, Trump's main racist trope, his way of waving the flag at other white racists, was to accuse the president of the United States of not being a citizen born in the United States, simply because you could look at his skin and tell what color he was, and therefore he had to have come from Africa. It was a racist lie. And the same thing with the wall. This is just a cutout, a stand-in for racist rhetoric, in my opinion, Joan. And I think you're right. It is destroying America. So what do we do about it?
I really feel sorry for whites because, you know, using the metaphor of the bus, the rich whites are driving the bus. The rest of the whites are in the middle of the bus. And they have been given straw man power to keep black people at the back of the bus.
Right.
But the whites in the middle of the bus aren't really being allowed to control anything that goes on in the front of the bus.
You're absolutely
got isolated.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that is produced, and by the way, that's been going on for 40 years, for a long, long time. And that has produced a lot of the backlash that I think both animated the Trump movement and the Bernie movement. Joan, thank you for the call. Welcome back. Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman program. Judy in Pine, Colorado. Hey, Judy, what's on your mind today?
Hi. The Israel anti-boycott bill that is in the Senate right now is going to be the start and of the finish of the First Amendment, along with the arrest and jailing of Julian Assange. Both freedom of speech and freedom of the press will be at the brink. Well, they're at the brink now, but with Julian's arrest, with this anti-Israel boycott law, the Israeli anti-boycott law, that opens everything up to stop speech on anything else they want to stop speech on. So the First Amendment is threatened right now. And Democrats, most Democrats are supporting this bill, that Americans, by this bill, Americans will be basically swearing allegiance to Israel.
Yeah,
there
was
to talk to anybody about Israel and boycotts or any sanctions or whatever, and they will not be able to join any protests that may have anything to do with being against actions being taken by Israel against the Palestinians.
Yep, you're right. And there was a, I believe it was a professor in, or maybe a PhD candidate, but I think it was a professor. Yeah, this was, oh, it was Angela Davis. Mm-hmm. You're right. Angela Davis was supposed to get this award. And because she had endorsed the BDS movement, the boycott and divestiture movement, you know, which is in opposition to Israel's policies with regard to, in particular, Gaza, but also the Palestinians in the West Bank, that they stripped her from the award from her. I mean, that's mind-boggling. And Mark Pocan, Congressman Pocan, a couple of days ago on this program, Wednesday, somebody called and asked him about this, and he said, this law is completely inconsistent with the First Amendment. You should have the right to say whether you're right or wrong, you know, whether it's you know, a high noble calling or whether it's, you know, something totally crazy. I mean, if Nazis have the right to march in Charlottesville, then people should have the right to say whether it's correct or not, that they disagree with Israel's policies. And
right.
And to criminalize that is mind-boggling.
So allowed to beat people up and not get arrested while peaceful protesters, if you're on the so-called left, get beat up by the cops, maced and arrested, thrown in jail, facing 70 years for conspiracy to riot. So our speech has already been threatened.
Oh, yeah. And this has been going on for a long time. This goes back to the first installation of free speech zones back in the late 90s. And, you know, around the president, where they said, you know, if you want to protest, you've got to go stand in this particular spot. And then, you know, Clinton started that out, and then George W. Bush just turned it into a thing. I mean, it was everywhere. Yep. And now Trump has taken that a step up. He, in his rallies are campaign rallies, and literally from the first day of his presidency. And because they are private campaign events, they can allow only people to come in who meet their criteria, which is, have you donated more than once to the Trump campaign? If you have, then you can come into these rallies. And so, you know, there's not nary a voice of dissent. And then the media covers it as if it's actually a public event, when it's not. These are all private events. So, the whole thing is bizarre. Judy, thank you for the call. Well said. Izzy in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Izzy, what's up?
Hey there. And just to lighten the mood a little bit, in light of our president telling FEMA not to help California out and that they need to clean it up themselves, I've decided that we've got a new slogan for him.
Okay.
It's Make America Rake Again.
Ha! Rake our forests. That's a good one. That's a good one. Make America Rake Again. Izzy, thank you. Thank you for calling and sharing that with us. James in Clear Lake Oaks, California. Hey, James, what's on your mind today?
Well, I'm reading about these prospective shutdowns of GM plants, and I wanted to know, you know, what you had to say.
Are you talking about
that,
the Ford plants in Europe? Or the GM plants in the Midwest?
The GM plants in the Midwest.
Okay.
Mainly, you know, not that the Ford closures are unimportant or whatever, but, you know, because it's also related to international trade and everything, and also related to, you know, electric vehicles and cutting down greenhouse gases.
Yeah, no, the reason I asked is because the GM stuff was a few weeks ago and the Ford stuff was a couple days ago. But so what's your question or point?
So basically, how soon do you think we should, as Democrats, shift our focus to that issue and maybe do something like work on a bipartisan solution to this wall thing, where maybe we'll say, okay, we'll give you $1 billion and you have to meet these requirements?
We already did. The legislation that passed the Senate unanimously last December 19th gave Trump $1.6 billion for the wall. That legislation was brought up in the House back last Thursday, and it passed with the majority of Democrats, with all of the Democrats and seven, as I recall, Republicans. And it gives Trump over $1 billion for the wall. He says no. And Mitch McConnell says no.
We need to own this issue of jobs, though.
No, I agree with you. And Sherrod Brown is all over that. And by the way, keep an eye on this guy when he's running for president. He's going to be a force to be reckoned with. But you're absolutely right. We'll see how it shakes out. James, thanks for the call. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
Anything Goes Friday. Back with more of your calls in just a moment. It's 34 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. On the line with us, we're going to get back to your calls in just a moment on Anything Goes Friday, but on the line with us is Harvey Kaye, professor of democracy and justice studies at the University of Wisconsin Green Bay, the author of numerous books. His latest, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. Today is the 75th anniversary of FDR's Second Bill of Rights. His Twitter handle is Harvey J. Kaye, K-A-Y-E. And his website, that's his Twitter handle. Harvey, welcome back to the program.
Tom, good to hear your voice.
It's nice to have you on. So I don't think most Americans even know that a sitting president of the United States 75 years ago today called for free college education for everybody, free health care for everybody, and an absolute guarantee that your job will pay you enough that you can have a reasonable standard of living, along with two other things.
That shows you how effective the suppression of memory has been by conservatives and how much the left or liberals at best have turned their backs on a tremendous legacy, the legacy we ought to be reviving today.
Yeah, amen. So tell us about it.
Well, when FDR ran for president originally in 1932, he first called for an economic declaration of rights. And I don't know how many people actually took him seriously when he said that, but I think he was sincere even at that time. And then in 1941, when the United States had yet to enter World War II, he delivered a State of the Union message which called for, at least the pursuit of, a world characterized by four essential freedoms: freedom of speech and expression, freedom of worship, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. And it did become the sort of guiding philosophy of the war effort. But I still don't think people were quite ready to take it as seriously as he probably intended it. And then in 1944, in the State of the Union message, with the intention of running again for president that year, he put even more emphasis on those four freedoms by elaborating and stating in that message this Bill of Rights, a second Bill of Rights or an economic Bill of Rights. And really, it became not simply a sort of handy device in the State of the Union message, but the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, they actually launched a major campaign that year in 1944, making that vision of a second Bill of Rights the heart of the campaign. They went out, they were going to organize people to vote, they issued pamphlets. I mean, it was a tremendous project on their part. And, of course, FDR won once again, his fourth time for president. Now, I can tell you that kind of speech was not welcomed by Republicans, and was not necessarily welcomed by Southern Democrats. And FDR was under no illusion that he would be able to see the enactment of that second Bill of Rights he was calling for. However, he did envision the possibility that after the war, those kinds of freedoms, those kinds of rights would become part of American public discourse and possibly enacted in various forms. And I'll just add that though it did not happen in that way, of course, the GI Bill of Rights, which was enacted in 44 and 45, became very much the basis upon which the United States took off after World War II and literally created the middle class.
Right. It was with all these things. So go through the five elements of the Second Bill of Rights.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting list. He actually calls, I'll just read a few of the lines, the right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation. And notice, and recreation.
Right, you can take a vacation every year.
Yeah, exactly. That was essential for not only economic security, but for well-being. He actually mentions the right of every farmer to raise and sell his produce at a return which will give him and his family a decent living. The right of every family to a decent home. How's that for a concept?
Right, guaranteed housing, that's right.
Right, the right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health, which I think goes back also to that idea of recreation.
Right.
Similarly, he talks about the right to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment. And by no means the least of them, the right to a good education. And let's not forget, let's not forget that FDR himself, in that GI Bill of Rights, envisioned the education and the training of an entire generation of young Americans who had enlisted and fought or been drafted and fought in some fashion in World War II. And that involved up to 16 million young Americans.
And he accomplished that, by the way. I mean,
And you bet, 12 million of the veterans, which included men and women, actually took advantage of those things. And as I said, it really did lead to the development of not only a phenomenal higher education system in the United States, because colleges necessarily expanded, but also a generation literally improved themselves, radically transformed themselves and the nation at the very same time. And I would also add that vision of the Second Bill of Rights also comes up as part of the Great Society initiatives of the 1960s.
Of LBJ. Yeah. Amen.
Right.
So hopefully, as more and more Democratic candidates are stepping forward to talk about, yes, I would like to be president, we already have,
right.
Yeah, we've got several so far. Elizabeth Warren was first to announce. It looks like Kamala Harris is going to be next. Sherrod Brown is making some noises. These are all good, solid progressives who I would think would be 100% behind the Second Bill of Rights. And in my opinion, it's time for the Democratic Party to return to its FDR roots and just start overtly saying these kinds of things.
Right. I would remind people that in November of 2015, Bernie actually gave a speech at Georgetown University, which was nationally streamed, in which he reminded Americans of FDR's Second Bill of Rights or Economic Bill of Rights. I can readily imagine AOC, Ocasio-Cortez, resurrecting these things. I mean, for what it's worth, I'm tweeting this as much as I can to get the word out. I noticed there's an article in The Nation today. I mean, there is discussion.
Mm-hmm.
A smart set of Democrats, we need a vision. And this would be the basis for that kind of vision.
Yeah. Amen. Harvey Kaye, professor of democracy and justice studies at the University of Wisconsin in Green Bay, the author of The Fight for the Four Freedoms, among other numerous and brilliant books. My favorite of all the things you've written is your book on Thomas Paine. What was the title of that again?
Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, still alive and well, so they can find it in various places.
There you go. Harvey, and you can tweet him at Harvey J. Kaye. Harvey, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Anytime. Thank you.
My pleasure. Great talking with you. It's a marvelous day. Jeff in San Francisco, listening on AM 910, Real Talk, I believe it's called. Jeff, you're on the air.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I just want to announce that we, the Public Bank Institute in San Francisco, had a big old party. I sent you a tweet about this. You might look for it.
Okay.
And we had 250 people there celebrating our push for a public bank and putting on the November ballot coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big success. And we had, I'd say, over 50 to 60% were young people there. So that was
marvelous.
I'd like to shout out to, a lot of this was infused by Standing Rock and the people who partake in that. And that's what inspired Alexandria Cortez to really go for it.
Yeah.
And so I just think the Native American population that fought for Standing Rock needs a big shout out, because
yeah,
they really
and if public banks are going to happen someplace in the United States, I mean, it happened in North Dakota back in 1919 or something like that.
100-year anniversary coming up.
Yeah, there you go. And but it's the only state in the union that does this, where the state actually runs all the money that it generates and that it taxes and that it spends. All that money goes through a bank owned by the state. So all the money made from banking activities becomes profit for the state. If California did this, the state would literally save billions of dollars every year. Billions.
Trillions. It's unbelievable how much money we actually have. If you think of your home as an equity in it, how much do you think equity we have in just all the public places that we own, where we could pull out 20% of equity out of it and use creativity in our banking?
Yeah, you know? No, it's absolutely mind-boggling. Jeff, good luck with that, and keep us up to date on how it goes. I appreciate the call. Justin in Chula Vista, California. Hey, Justin, what's on your mind today?
Hi, I wrote out a question. I just wanted to ask it to you, so here it goes. So I've recently gotten into the works of Richard Wolff. I've heard some of his talks. I started reading one of his books, and I've really enjoyed the idea of workers' cooperatives and you know, general syndicalism and collectivization, right? These ideas. I know you talked to him in the past, so I think you guys are pretty in line with these concepts. And now that I'm sold on this idea of worker-controlled enterprises, what are the logistics in actually moving to democratized workplace?
I wrote a book about this. It's called Threshold, The Crisis of Western Civilization. In the last chapter of it, Louise and I went over to Mondragon, the place that Richard Wolff is always talking about. This was maybe 10 years ago when I wrote the book. We went over there and met with the senior management and whatnot. This is the largest co-op in the world. I think they do about $50 billion a year in business in like 15 or 20 different countries, maybe more. And it's entirely worker-owned. The CEO makes four times what the lowest-paid janitor makes. It's an extraordinary model. I also traveled to Wisconsin up to Madison and interviewed Peninsula Engineering, I think is the name of the company. It's a tool and die maker or a precision parts manufacturer, which is employee-owned. Interviewed the people who worked at Union Cab Company, which is an employee-owned, worker-owned co-op. There are certain state laws that make it easier to set up co-ops, and some states make it very easy, some states make it very difficult. Wisconsin's very friendly to co-ops, Louisiana's very hostile to them. So, number one, you need a consistency among our state laws across the country. And then number two, we need to stop giving extraordinary benefits and subsidies to for-profit corporations and start offering some of those above and beyond just what for-profit corporations get to these nonprofit entities that are worker-owned co-ops. Justin, thanks for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour, back with more of your calls. Well, actually, we're going to check in with Talk Media News here in 4 minutes and get the news, and then we'll continue with Anything Goes Friday. And welcome back, Paul in Lucerne, California. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I have a pretty decent way I think we can reduce our carbon footprint pretty quickly. There's no big trucks, diesels, on the drawing board. All right, so we just make sure all our diesels convert to bio. And the same with our trains. See, our trains run on electric generators run by diesel engines. Make them run on biodiesel. It would help our farmers out. It would reduce our footprint. And it's something we could do real quickly.
Yeah, that could be done rapidly. You know, Elon Musk is also making electric long-haul trucks. And
yeah, but you have to switch batteries and stuff. A truck driver has to be able to go, and he doesn't have time. You know, during his layover, if they can make the battery last as long as he can drive, then you're good to go.
Yeah.
But if you can't, you don't have time to do that. But
yeah.
With biodiesel, the diesel was originally designed to run on peanut oil as a competitor to gas.
Yep. And gas was originally designed to run on alcohol. And diesels were originally designed to run on basically kerosene.
No, peanut oil.
Oh, peanut oil. Okay.
Yeah, that's what the guy designed it for, because the guy knew that burning gas was going to pollute the planet, cause a greenhouse effect, and eventually kill the planet.
Yeah. Well, no, I think you're absolutely right, Paul. There, you know, the fact of the matter is that we subsidize the fossil fuel industry here in the United States to the tune of about $300 billion a year, and that's what we've got to stop. Step one toward anything, including a Green New Deal, is to stop the subsidies to fossil fuels. Paul, thanks for the call. Very well said. Corky in Rochester, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up?
How you doing, Tom? There's only one way to get Trump out of here. You start making fun of the guy. He can't stand that.
Yeah.
Everybody make fun of his stupid ideas.
Well, I think that's why Schumer and Pelosi are using the word tantrum repeatedly.
Yeah.
And Schumer did everything except say that, you know, he slammed his little tiny hand down on the desk.
Oh, that would have really set him off.
Yeah.
Yeah, and once you make fun of him, once you get rid of the head of the snake, then the rest of the body dies. All the Trump followers, they'll feel like fools for supporting him.
Yeah, for supporting a guy who had been regularly and roundly ridiculed. So the challenge here, Corky, is, you know, how do you convince the news media that Trump has disrespected them by lying to them and lying about them, and therefore they no longer need to respect him, even if they want to respect the office, and therefore they can be disrespectful in a way that's comedic. I mean, I see this happening on the evening shows, and you know, I catch the clips of Colbert and the Daily Show with Mr. Trevor Noah and so on, but I'm certainly not seeing this in the news.
Well, you've seen it in the 2011 breakfast, or you know.
Oh, you're talking about the correspondence dinner. Louise and I were there. We watched Donald Trump get taken down by Barack Obama. We were just maybe 100 yards away. It was pretty amazing. Or maybe 50 yards away, actually. Yeah, Corky, thanks a lot for the call. I agree, but I don't run the media. But I do run this show, and no problem making fun of Trump here. I'll be back with Luke Vargas of Talk Media News in just a moment. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check in with Talk Media News and find out what's going on in the world today. This report brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and Loving What You Do, Ellen Ratner's new book. On the line with us is Luke Vargas, the chief foreign correspondent for Talk Media News. He joins us today from the UN in New York. If you want to hear Luke break down one new world news story every day, search Luke Vargas or Talk Media News, wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, Luke. So U.S. is starting to pull out of Syria. Tell me about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest takeaway today, and I will precede any of my comments by saying I'm not judging this strategy. I'm just sort of reporting the sequence of events here. I mean, what's confusing is that we were told earlier this week from John Bolton and also from Mike Pompeo yesterday and other officials that, you know, the administration has abandoned any sort of hasty timeline that isn't tied to conditions on the ground. But then we learned today, and what they said were the two conditions would be a protection, a promise to protect the Kurds coming from Turkey, and this is a very, you know, sort of difficult to define objective, but a lasting defeat of ISIS would need to be achieved before we withdraw.
Yeah, and on their first point, Erdogan comes out and says, "No way, forget it. You're insulting me."
Yeah. No, precisely right. I guess to stay with the first point about the promise from the Turks. We had John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, doing an interview with Hugh Hewitt today in which he says he, Mike Pompeo, and President Trump all understand that, quote, Turkey is committed not to harm the Kurds who fought with us versus ISIS, end quote. I mean, this to me reminds me of the language surrounding the official explanations about Khashoggi coming from the Saudi government. Hey, we believe it. We think we've gotten the assurance. They tell us they're not going to do it. We believe them. And I think it's pretty difficult to say any sort of assurance like that exists, given that you saw Turkey's defense minister just today saying a military offensive against various Kurdish groups in Syria is actually being drawn up as we speak.
Right.
So, you know, so then the other one is the lasting defeat of ISIS. We'll put that aside. I mean, I just don't know how you do more of a military defeat against ISIS as your troops are leaving. But what we learned today is indeed military equipment has already started to leave the battle area. Not troops yet. In fact, it's for the short term. It looks like more troops are actually being brought into Syria in order to help, you know, guard facilities and stuff as equipment is taken out. But I think it all comes around to this sort of realization that the signals are getting crossed. The military, when, talked to by the AP today, some military officials are saying, hey, we don't take cues from John Bolton. We got orders to withdraw, and we're executing that because that's the last order we got. And it just makes me think this would not be happening if General Mattis were still chairing the Defense Department. I mean,
yes.
It's just hard to imagine some sort of bungled crosswires type of line of command quite of the sort we're seeing now. And then on the political side, I still just think it's not really viable to pretend that our leverage vis-a-vis the Turks to try to get a promise about the Kurds is going to increase as our troops leave. We're going to be basically showing less and less of an ability to shape any of the future events in Syria, and yet still maybe or perhaps increasingly urgently asking them to give us political concessions. And so something's got to give here.
And if I'm remembering correctly, Luke, this all started when noted libertarian Rand Paul went golfing mm-hmm. with Donald Trump and said, you know, you campaigned on being a non-interventionist, and what are you doing in Syria? We shouldn't be there. And Trump said, okay. And he went back and the next morning announced, we're pulling out of Syria, before he'd even talked to his generals. He'd just talked to Rand Paul. Am I remembering that right?
I think the only other thing I would add to that timeline is around the same time, it may have even been before the Rand Paul bit, is there's a phone call with the Turkish president.
Oh, that's right.
Erdogan.
That's right. That was the big one, actually.
But it was reported that Erdogan, like, really deftly sort of repeated back President Trump's campaign talking points to him.
That's right.
In a way which just sort of caused him to change policy on the spot. So, again, no judgment. I don't know how you, you know, frankly, we're picking between a lot of bad case scenarios in Syria. Is you're not going to really get the kind of perfect exit that maybe some people think is possible. But yet I still think there's just a lot of evidence of confusion within the chain of command, and I think that's just what highlights.
This highway, or how do you pronounce it, H-U-E-W-E-I, highway?
Huawei.
Thank you. Thank you, Luke. This Huawei story, is the Huawei, the daughter of the founder, is she still in jail in Canada?
It's been since December 1st, so that's drawing on. The news today is that there's been an arrest by Polish authorities of a prominent Polish cyber intelligence official and the Poland country director for Huawei, who have now been charged with spying for China. I think two bits are really interesting here. One is that the director at Huawei in Poland was a former embassy official, and this is a pattern we're seeing quite a bit, which is that Chinese, you know, foreign policy officials who have a really good sense of foreign countries are in many times circulated into the telecom industry, which I think is a suspicious thing. I mean, clearly revolving doors are not pretty commonplace in the United States, but why is it that, you know, a telecom company needs such people who know the inside?
Well, the accusation against Huawei was that they were building basically backdoors, trapdoors, whatever they're called, into not just their phones, but into their switching equipment, their telecommunications equipment, that phone companies use to run cell towers. So China could basically listen in on any conversation anywhere, anytime that they wanted. And awful lot of the equipment used all over the world is manufactured by Huawei.
Yeah, no, Huawei's goal is to roll out 5G across Europe and Africa and South America, in many of these countries getting their first really top-notch cell phone network conveniently built by them. I think the Poland case is particularly interesting. The Polish official who's arrested had previously worked to build a secure communication system for Poland's political leaders. And in the same year it's coming out, Huawei offered to the Polish government, free of charge, a Chinese telecom conference system. And so, put it all together, are we seeing some sort of thing where the Chinese served up a technology with a backdoor on it, then you have an official within the Polish intelligence install that system for the use of Poland's leaders, and then of course the Chinese would probably be the beneficiaries of whatever they can listen to in those calls.
Thus the spy charge.
Seem to be the setup. Yeah, right. Thus the spy charge. And just say very briefly, let's watch Poland here. They've been mentioned a lot by the U.S. recently as helping to contain Iran.
Yeah.
Now they're playing a bit part in this broader U.S.-China trade war, a country to watch.
Got it. Okay, Luke Vargas. You can check out his podcast. Just Google Luke Vargas, or, you know, wherever you get your podcasts, or search for it. Talk Media News, chief foreign correspondent. Luke, thanks a lot for dropping by today.
Thank you, Tom. Take care.
And you can follow Luke over on Twitter at The Courier. We'll be back with more of Anything Goes Friday right after this. It's coming up on 58 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.